This clip comes from the 1981 film Chariots of Fire. The movie tells the story of two British athletes who ran in the 1924 Olympics, Harold Abrahams and Eric Liddell. These men were both talented sprinters, but they ran for very different reasons. Abrahams was the son of a Lithuanian Jew, and although he was privileged enough to attend the University of Cambridge, he experienced prejudice due to his heritage. This gave him somewhat of a chip on his shoulder, and he saw running as a way he could prove his worth, both to his colleagues and to himself. Liddell, born to Christian missionaries in China, ran to glorify God. He used his celebrity status as a platform to share the gospel. Now, his sister Jenny criticized him for postponing mission work to train and compete. But as Liddell says in the clip, "I believe God made me for a purpose, but he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure." For Liddell, running was an avenue to connect with God. The movie ends with this line written across the screen. Eric Liddell, missionary, died in occupied China at the end of World War II. All of Scotland mourned. What was it about this man that was so striking, so remarkable, that his life and death would leave such an impact? Perhaps if I read about what his family, friends, and co-workers said about him, we'll get an idea. He was literally God-controlled in his thoughts, judgments, actions, and words to an extent I've never seen surpassed and rarely seen equaled. Every morning, he rose early to pray and read the Bible in silence, talking and listening to God, pondering the day ahead, and often smiling as if at a private joke. He was not particularly clever and not conspicuously able, but he was good. He wasn't a great leader or an inspired thinker, but he knew what he ought to do and did it. Of all the men I've ever known, Eric Liddell was the one in whose character and life the Spirit of Christ was preeminently manifested. What was the secret of his consecrated life and far-reaching influence? Absolute surrender to God's will, as revealed in Jesus Christ. His was a God-controlled life, and he followed his Master and Lord with a devotion that never flagged, and with an intensity of purpose that made men both see the reality and the power of true religion. I love this quote. In the spiritual race, Eric ran to win. And he won gloriously, didn't he? During the worst period of his imprisonment, he was, through his courage and cheerfulness, a tower of strength and sanity to his fellow prisoners. To many sufferers, he brought the only comfort that captivity allowed. He was one of the most chivalrous of Scots as an athlete and as a man. Unlike many missionaries, Eric seemed able to relate to everyone. Of course, his celebrity status made him welcome in any conversation. But more than this, he had an unassuming, natural quality that gave him rapport with almost everyone he met. Everybody regarded Eric as a friend. Eric spoke with a charming Scottish brogue, and more than anyone else I've ever known, typified the joyful Christian life. He had a marvelous sense of humor, was full of laughter and practical jokes, but always in good taste. His voice was nothing but how he loved to sing, particularly the grand old hymns of the faith. I consider myself privileged to have been married to him. We were married only 11 years, and for 4 of these, we were separated. But I learned so much from him. It was a super marriage. He was a perfectly grand husband and so sweet with the children. How we long for words like these to be spoken over us when we pass from this life. We crave to be the kind of person who leaves people better than we found them, who leaves behind a legacy of love, endurance, and faith. These quotations came from people who knew Little as a preacher, as an athlete, as a husband, and as a friend. Last year, I gave the youth group a homework assignment to bring to our Wednesday night class. The assignment was to imagine that you are attending your own funeral. There are three speakers. The first is from your family, the second from your friends, and the third, in our students' cases, was a classmate. What would you like each of these speakers to say about you and your life? What kind of son, daughter, brother, sister, friend, and student would you like them to describe? What achievements and contributions would you like them to remember? What character traits would you like them to have seen in you? What difference would you like to have made in their lives? This exercise ended up being fairly successful at engaging everyone and producing some meaningful discussions. Almost everyone came prepared with written statements. How often do you get that with an ungraded homework assignment? Even those who had not come prepared were able to come up with answers that reflected thought and intention. I think this reveals that even at an early age, we are wired to be concerned with our legacies. As Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11 says, "He has set eternity in the human heart." This exercise came from Stephen Covey's best-selling book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. According to Covey, the second habit of highly effective people is to begin with the end in mind. In application, this means that you begin every day with the image, picture, or paradigm of the end of your life as your frame of reference or the criterion by which everything else is examined. When you have such a frame of reference, you can make tough decisions with confidence and peace of mind, knowing that you will spend time and energy on what is most important to you. Going back to the movie, part of what made that race so memorable was that Eric was never meant to be in that event. Eric trained and competed in the 100 meters, and this was the 400 meters race. What happened was that when the timetables were released for the Olympics, the heats of the 100 meters were on a Sunday. Because he believed that the Sabbath was meant to be a day of rest dedicated to God, Little withdrew. He didn't make a show of it, of his decision, and when he was interviewed about it, he just said, "I'm not running on a Sunday." The newspapers immediately went for his throat. They labeled him a traitor to king and country. But to Eric, he was maintaining loyalty to the highest king and the highest country. Keeping the end in mind helped Jesus make decisions too. Throughout the gospel, Jesus reminded his followers of why he came. John 12:46 says, "I have come as a light to shine in this dark world, so that all who put their trust in me will no longer remain in the dark." At the beginning of the chapter, Mary also made a decision based on keeping Jesus' end in mind. In verse 3, John says, "Mary took a 12-ounce jar of expensive perfume, and she anointed Jesus' feet with it, wiping his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance. But Judas Iscariot, the disciple who would later betray Jesus, said, 'That perfume was worth a year's wages. It should have been sold and the money given to the poor.' Jesus responds with this, 'Leave her alone. She did this in preparation for my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me.' Mary chose to honor Jesus in light of his future sacrifice instead of helping the poor. This is not the first time we see Mary choose Jesus over another noble pursuit. In Luke 10, starting at verse 39, it says, "Mary sat at the Lord's feet, listening to what he taught. But Martha was distracted by the big dinner she was preparing. She came to Jesus and said, "Lord, doesn't it seem unfair to you that my sister just sits here while I do all the work? Tell her to come and help me." But the Lord said to her, "My dear Martha, you are worried and upset over all these details. There is only one thing to be concerned about. Mary has discovered it, and it will not be taken away from her." The fact of the matter is, we all have limited time, energy, and money. And sometimes we must choose between using these resources for good or for evil. Many times, however, the choice is not between good and evil, but between a lesser good and a greater good. In Mary's case, she chose to listen to Jesus' teachings over helping her sister cook dinner. And later, she chose to use her expensive perfume to anoint Jesus instead of selling it to bless the less fortunate. In life, there are often multiple good options to choose from. So how do we distinguish the two? In his Seven Habits book, Covey acknowledges this difficulty. It's incredibly easy to get caught up in an activity trap, in the busyness of life, to work harder and harder at climbing the ladder of success, only to discover it's leaning against the wrong wall. It is possible to be busy, incredibly busy, without being very effective. You see, if we don't keep the larger goal in mind, it's really easy to get swept up by every urgent task that comes our way, or even worse, to get overwhelmed and do nothing. In 97, when my parents moved to West Africa as missionaries, my dad took up amateur woodworking as a hobby. As it turns out, he was in the perfect place. You see, Togo is an exporter of teakwood and mahogany, so he was able to buy some really high-quality wood for very cheap. I loved to go into his shop and watch him work. One of my favorite things he built for us was a wooden baseball bat. It was simple. It had a chip in the middle of it that had to be patched up with a sliver of leftover wood. Later, when a church donated trunks of baseball equipment, gloves and bats, we cut out a diamond in an empty field and taught the neighborhood kids how to play baseball. Pretty sure we are the first and only baseball league in West Africa. There were plenty of aluminum bats that were lighter and could hit farther, but we loved the wooden bat the best. I think it is no small coincidence that for most of Jesus' adult life, his vocation was carpentry. There's an old proverb in the woodworking community: measure twice, cut once. My grandpa, my dad's father, built his house by hand. The building process took blood, sweat, and tears. But he'd admit to you, almost more time and effort went into the planning and designing of the house. You see, the more specific a picture you can create in your head of the house you want, and the more detailed a blueprint you can draw for the home, the less heartache and headache you will have when it comes to break the ground and cut the planks. Every mistake in execution is costly, sometimes irreversible. This doesn't mean that mistakes won't happen if you're thorough in the planning process. In life, it's not a matter of if we mess up, but when we mess up. But, that being said, the more time we invest in the first creation, the mental picture of the life we want to live, the less we give in to the temptations and distractions of this world. Matthew 7:14. "But small is the gate, and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it." And in Ephesians 4, verse 14, "Then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves, and blown here and there by every wind of teaching, and by the cunning and craftiness of people in their deceitful scheming." In the clip earlier, you may have noticed Eric Little's unusual running technique. Even for his day, to run with knees out in front, head tilted back, mouth open, and arms flailing in circles, was eccentric, to say the least. Here's what Harold Abrahams, Eric Little's rival that I mentioned earlier, had to say about his form. "No runner of his superb ability ever possessed a worse style. It was unorthodox in the extreme. Indeed, my reaction on seeing him perform for the first time was that I was witnessing the most misplaced direction of great energy I'd ever imagined possible." Even his wife, Florence, remarked, "The way he threw his head back, it was so ridiculous. Boy, I couldn't understand how he could ever see. When I asked him, he just said, 'I knew where I was going all right.'" My guess is that Eric Little knew where he was going because he had his eyes fixed on the one who is taking him there. One of his favorite Bible verses came from Isaiah 40, verse 31. "But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint." I've spent the last several minutes talking about beginning with the end in mind, so I want to be clear about something. Christians have a very different end in mind from the rest of the world. To a non-Christian, death is the end. The only hope for a life of meaning is to distinguish yourself through popularity and achievement. Very few people will work hard enough and be fortunate enough to stand out in this way. If these individuals happen to make it into the newspapers, the record books, and the history textbooks, they're mostly remembered by the students who begrudgingly have to memorize the names and dates to pass their tests in school. After the grades come in, the names are quickly forgotten. Chariots of Fire is a beloved film in my family. We all love to run. My dad was a runner. He ran his first marathon when he was 11. And you better believe that we were going to run in the mornings before school. But we all grew to love it, some of us more than most. Anyway, my dad introduced us to this Oscar-winning film early in our childhood. And when I was in college, then-President Bruce McLarty implemented an annual Harding Read. Every student and faculty member was given a book of the year, and lessons of the book were incorporated into the classroom and into chapel. In chapel, a week was dedicated to watching a movie based on the principles from the book. My senior year, the book was The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, which I had taken a class on my senior year of high school. And the movie was Chariots of Fire, which, as I mentioned, was a beloved film in our family. My initial excitement at the prospect of sharing both of these treasured works quickly turned to dread. Chariots of Fire was a dated movie, and I knew it would be considered cheesy by my generation's standards. Sure enough, just as I feared, I'm sitting in chapel, and every part that I'm tearing up at, every part that deeply moves me, my friends are making internet memes about and are laughing at. The quote from C.S. Lewis' Abolition of Man came to mind. "We make men without chests and expect from them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst." The trivialization of virtue and honor and reverence in America is a topic for another time. My point is this: even our heroes can be forgotten and become objects of ridicule. No matter how hard we work, no matter how popular we become, no matter how much we accomplish, the pursuit of our own individual glory is vanity, a chasing after the wind, as King Solomon would say. Eric Little said that God made him for a purpose, but God also made him fast. Talented as Little was, he never confused his gift for his purpose. We were made to glorify God. As Christians, we may have different vocations, we may have different talents and abilities, but we all are united by the same mission, by the same purpose, to tell the world about Jesus. Hebrews 12:1-2. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. This is our race. This is the end we keep in mind. One day we will meet God, and everything we say, think, and do should revolve around that fact. When that day comes, do we want to hear from God, "Well done, my good and faithful servant," or do we want to hear, "I never knew you"? This is why we're here. This is what we're preparing our spouses for. This is the day that we're preparing our children for. This is why we must tell people about Jesus. This is our race. This is the end we keep in mind. So let us fix our eyes on Jesus and run the race set before us.